So we're looking at the text in the reader, in a way, and theories of reception. And Stanley Fish is quite an entertaining writer. So this is my take on Fish. So a text is read or received by someone for some group. And here we'll examine in more detail the third aspect of... did we talk about the semiotic triangle?
No.
Where you've got... a sign is always that you've got a sign and of something, but it's always interpreted by a third community or a third community of reception. So there are three figures here who are important. Wolfgang Isser, who's developed reader response criticism, and he emphasised the text as the experience of the reader. And he says the text is given to consciousness and criticism, and is a description of the reader's path through a text. So that's what reading is about. So reader response criticism is the analysis of the ways in which the reader forms meanings through reference to other texts, completing the meaning, and so on. Now that's, if you remember, that's what Hirsch called the significance. He said that the meaning didn't change, but the significance changed. So, well, it's a... I mean, Isser's writing before Hirsch, but that would be Hirsch's take on that position. Another one, Jauss wrote on the aesthetics of reception, and the text is the answer to a horizon of expectations in a reader. And he says the focus shouldn't be on the individual reader, but on the history of the text reception, how the text has been received through time. And finally, you've got Stanley Fish, who writes about the importance of not of the individual reader, but the community of readers, the interpretative community of reception. So we've read this, is there a text in this class? And it starts with that. The student comes up to me and says, is there a text in this class? Or is it just us, she says, or something. Do we believe in poems and things, he says. Do we believe in poems and things, or is it just us? And he describes this as the postmodern problem in which no text can mean anything in particular, and we can never say just what anyone means by anything he writes. The literal or normative readings are overridden by willful interpreters, he says. But what is a normative or literal reading? So, for example, is there a text in this class? He says. The text has two... That text, is there a text in this class, has two literal meanings. One is that it's about a textbook. So, you know, is there a text in this class? Means is there a book of poems that we read for the class or something? And the second is... that it's about the instructor's position on the status of the text. So they're both literal meanings of that. And both understandings are not imposed on text, but a function of public and constituting norms of language and understanding. And these norms inhere within, quote, an institutional structure within which one hears utterances as already organised with reference to certain assumed purposes and goals. Now, if we call these two readings, is there a text in this class 1, and is there a text in this class 2, then 1 is interpretable only by someone who knows what is included under the general rubric first day of class, says Fish. He says there could also be an is there a text in this class 3, but I'm not quite sure what that is. What
that could be. He says that if a student left their textbook in class, they might come up and say, is there a text in the class? Did you find my textbook?
Right, oh, I see, yeah.
As far as I remember.
It's unlikely
that. Is that a further interpretation?
Yeah, that's a
maybe
further interpretation.
Maybe by the student as opposed to the instructor? Sorry, I didn't know.
yeah, he says that's a third one. Yeah, I'm not convinced by that, but... I don't think the student... I mean, even his fundamental... Is there a text in this class? Meaning...
But doesn't he mean is there a subtext or something?
Yeah.
Because to me, I couldn't get it for ages. Like, I don't really know what you're saying, but yeah. I assume it's like a subtext, like an agenda or something. Is that what you meant by that?
By that last one, the third one.
No, by is there a text in this class number two?
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure if I grasped that.
Right. Is it...
The poems and things, like, that didn't explain it to me.
Right, it's the question... It's the question of... the objectivity of the text. So, do we believe in poems and things means? Does this class adhere to the notion of an objectivity of the text, or textual meaning lies outside of the community of reception? Or do we say that the meaning of the text is purely within the community of reception? But
the class three is still only literal he's talking about. He's not talking about any other interpretation.
No, that's right.
It's still only literal. Three literal he's talking about.
Well, would you actually say that? Is there a text in this class? You wouldn't say that, would you? You'd say, did I leave my book behind or something? Or did I leave my text here for three? Anyway, we'll leave three.
I might.
You
might say that. Yeah. And he says, but there is a sense in which one reading is more normal than another. More people would hear one than two. And that's true. Someone able to hear two would be able to hear one, but not vice versa. So if you can understand, is there a text in this class meaning... What's the course text? You can understand. Everyone can understand that. But the second meaning, is there a text in this class meaning, what's the position of the instructor with regard to the nature of text? Not everybody could hear. But if you can understand the second, you'll understand the first, he says. So he's talking about the normal. What is normative, really? So the category of the normal is therefore not transcendental, but institutional. So he's against the phenomenologists here. This accounts for the success of Hirsch and others. This accounts for the success of Hirsch. Doesn't make sense, that sentence, does it? And others, obviously, this accounts for the success of Hirsch. Get rid of that "of." And others can appeal to a shared understanding of ordinary language. So that was from week one, actually, wasn't it? Week one, not week two. And then he says, furthermore, the obviousness of the utterance's meaning is not a function of the values its words have in a linguistic system that is independent of context. Rather, it is because the words are heard as already embedded in a context that they have meaning that Hirsch can then cite as obvious. So it's a dig at Hirsch. So Hirsch is blind to the context in which the text operates. It's impossible, says Fish, to think of a sentence independently of a context. When a context is not specified, we will automatically hear it in the context in which it has most often been encountered. Hirsch invokes a context by not invoking it. And then he goes on about the philosopher's non-comprehension of two versus Fish's class anticipation of two. Now, yeah, that's the... Yes, the philosopher might not comprehend that second position, but the class understood the second position. That's interesting.
And when he did, it was only because he was out, something that you would say. I can imagine you saying that.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't in his own head that he, in his own context, he had to switch to try and, you know, think in Fish's shoes in order to understand it.
Yeah. Who did? The
philosopher.
Yeah.
Actually grasped it. He was like, oh, yeah, it's actually a convention.
That's right.
It was in your context, but it's outside my context.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So he also quotes this fellow Abrams. So he says, Abrams and Hirsch assume that authority depends on the determinate core of meanings, because in the absence of such a core, there is no normative or public way of construing what anyone says, and his meanings therefore are put into the private realm. this is, he doesn't agree with this position, of course. In literary criticism, this has the implication that no interpretation is more valid than any other. But, he says, communication occurs in situations that assume a structure of assumptions. There are practices of understanding and goals already in place. Language is already perceived from the first within a structure of norms. A counter-argument is that this leads to relativism. However, everyone is situated somewhere, and so the idea that an asituational norm makes no sense for such a person, i.e. for anyone. Prior availability delimits in advance the paths of a consciousness. So, one, communication does occur in spite of no context-free system of meaning. Two, those who participate in communication do so confidently, they are not relativists. And three, confidence is the result of a set of beliefs which are not individual specific, but communal and conventional. So that's his counter-Hirsch position. Which does raise some interesting questions. So on the one hand, we've got Hirsch, who talks about the meaning of a text is the author's intention, is embedded in the text, and that is unchanging in this fixed. But what changes is the significance of that meaning for a particular historical period or reception. And Fish disagrees with that, in saying that the meaning of the text is entirely within the community of reception's understanding. But it seems to me that Fish doesn't really answer that Hirsch's point of the intentionality in the text. So in his view, the meaning of the text is context dependent always. But what about the notion of inaccuracy? How do you judge inaccurate readings if you don't have some notion of objectivity of the text? So is there a text in this class? I think he's trying to say that the interpretation of that as referring to the position of the instructor is not an inaccurate reading of that text. But it actually has no objective meaning beyond the community of reception. It's entirely context dependent. But can you? Maybe you have to introduce the notion of grades of text or types of text. I mean, is there a text in this class? Is a text which is very context dependent. It's kind of illocutionary text, I suppose. But if you've got a text like Moby Dick or the Bible or the Bhagavad Gita, is that a text? Surely that's a completely different class of text. And that Fish's position doesn't work with regard to those kinds of texts. I don't know, what do you think? So, I mean, this raises questions. Is this discussion relevant outside of literary studies? What's the status of philology for Fish, say? Which entails establishing a stable text. So presumably Fish would be rather dismissive of critical emendation and these kinds of practices. And what's the status of revelation for a community if meaning is contextual, purely contextual?
Contextual in that sense is contextual in the context of the community,
yeah,
rather than within the context of the verse or sutra,
yeah,
or whatever.
That's right, that's right. If it's just meaningful for a particular community at any particular yeah. time, and those meanings vary depending on the interests of the community, mm. it takes away any notion of objectivity of the text. You might be happy with that, but it does raise questions mm. about the legitimacy of that position.
I don't really see how he's like proved that there isn't an objective position in this. I mean, he said that there isn't, and that there's a contextual position.
Yeah.
But that doesn't deny that there also is an objective position at the same moment. I don't think
right,
one or the other necessarily.
Uh-huh.
So if you're talking about like revelation.
Yeah,
it obviously has a contextual meaning, and he would agree with that. But that doesn't deny that it might also be able to transcend that. And he himself doesn't deny that things can transcend textual meaning. It's
yeah.
just that contextual meaning is the thing that we basically tap into every time we try and interpret something.
Mm.
It's the thing that's mm. the most available.
Mm.
But it doesn't mm. deny that we can switch frameworks in the same way as his philosopher guy was able to switch frameworks mm. and inhabit another contextual, because in some ways there must be something beyond the contextual.
Right. There must be, in the first place, for the colleague to switch positions, you mean, there must be something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Contextual.
Yeah. Something which is transcontextual or outside of there isn't. It's just in another context, isn't it? You've got innumerable contexts, I suppose, which overlap.
You've got different contexts, yes.
All the time. In which the
that's
text
why
has,
contextual. It depends on your definition of contextual in relation to that question.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm saying is that isn't there not something which will transcend the contextual position, which can inhabit?
Which is the context. Text itself? You mean like the text itself transcends that?
No, but a meaning which can
cross over.
So that's why, you know, somebody who isn't an Indian raised in a Hindu tradition
yeah.
can interpret the symbolism of the Vedas and things, because there is something which it alludes to which is beyond context, even though it uses context to express itself. It's very, very Indian.
Yeah.
But at the same moment, we can
understand it.
Yeah.
Mm.
Because it must tap into something which is beyond context.
Yeah. And that thing which is beyond context is presumably, or Hirsch, would be the meaning of the text, the author's intention.
Yes, the author's intention.
That's what he would say, Hirsch would say.
Yeah, the ultimate author's intention.
Yeah, I'm sympathetic to that. The things survive translation, don't they? Mm-hmm. Meaning survives translation. Sometimes not very well.
No, that's the problem.
That's the problem.
Yes.
The thing I think the idea that he brings out that I find, you know, appealing and is sort of relevant for when it comes to sacred texts and so on, this idea of you know, he says the. His colleague, you know, the student comes up to him and says, is there a text in this class? And he
yeah.
assumes, oh, you know, she's asking about, is there a textbook for this class? So he says, yes, you know, read this book. And,
yeah.
and then she says, oh, no, but this is, it's not about that. But
yeah.
I meant, you know, do we, you know, is there an sort of objective text in this yeah. class or not? And so he explains that when he realizes, his colleague realizes that he sort of misunderstood what the student was asking, he kind of doesn't, it's not that he was misreading the text, but he says he was mis-pre-reading the text, and so he had a different sort of context, a different
mm.
assumption that he brought to his interpretation of that. And
mis-pre-reading the text, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And I think when it comes to sort of the interpretation of sacred texts, you know, when you look at how people do it rather than you're doing it yourself, that's sort of what you see. You know, you have different people that bring different things to the table when they're reading the text. They
mm.
see the text in a different context
mm.
and come up with different,
mm.
you know, someone...
of their own lives or something, you mean?
Sorry?
Of their own kind of stories or something, their own...
Yeah, I mean, well, someone like Madhva or Dayanan Saraswati, who reads the Vedas and argues that they're monotheistic texts, they see these texts in a certain context, and so they're sort of pre-reading the text already before they're actually reading the text.
Yeah.
There are certain things they...
But can we say at any point that actually they're misreading the text? This is a...
Well, he doesn't seem to go in that.
No, he doesn't.
He doesn't seem to. And the impression I got is he didn't seem to care so much about that.
No. That's the problem, it seems to me, that you have to have... That you have to have the notion of possibility of misreading in order to have corrective readings. Otherwise, you could get... if one reading is just as good as any other, that has that has problematic consequences. So it could have the problematic social and political consequences. And then, if it's just argument, then what establishes one reading over another? Is it rationality, or is it simply power?
But if by bringing that question into the discussion, are we not bringing something in that he's not claiming to talk about? Because he really, I mean, if you have the semiotic triangle, he's really in the reception, in the community of reception, and sort of he doesn't seem to care so much about whether the text actually has an objective meaning or whether through philology you can get to a critical edition of the text or text of the author, disabled text.
So he's not interested in it, is he?
But he just seems to, and at least that's how I read it, that he seems to be interested merely in the question that, okay, here's a text, how will this be received, how will this be interpreted, rather than how will this be correctly interpreted, or...
Yes, that's right. That's
more of a... Yeah.
He doesn't have that idea, does he? I think you're right, but he doesn't seem interested, really.
I mean, I've only read this with him.
Yeah, that's right. I think you're right. He's
rather interested. Pointless, then, isn't it?
With those limitations to his ideas, I actually like them.
Within that constraint. Yeah. I enjoy reading his work. He's an entertaining writer, I think.
But does he actually say anything new? Like,
does he?
Well, I think it was new at the time.
But if he's not interested in whether it's properly interpreted or misinterpreted or whatever, isn't that a huge gap in his...
I think it's a gap. I think it's problematic. If you don't have a notion of some notion of objective text, some constraint on your... The text provides constraints upon the possibilities of understanding for a community. So you must be able to challenge a community's reading of a text. And how do you do that? You do that through reason. You can do it through reasoning. Or you have to introduce some notion of the objective meaning or meaning of the text that goes beyond a community's reception. So I suppose objective meaning, you could understand objective meaning as a constraint upon reception, but which in itself you can never get to, perhaps. You can never actually get to the objective meaning of the text. But nevertheless, it acts as a constraint upon possibilities of reading.
I think another issue is how to resolve the conflict of interpretations.
Yeah.
For example, Shakespeare has become a controversial text nowadays. Some traditional British context or British school still wants to teach Shakespeare, but some Muslim group says Shakespeare teaches all kind of bad virtues for Muslims.
Ah.
Yeah, so I think if there are different contexts, there must be
That's right.
Conflict of interpretation.
That's very interesting. There must be a conflict of interpretation. That's a very good example, yeah. Yeah, so you shouldn't take Shakespeare because it teaches bad values in the contemporary context. It teaches that Muslims are bad or something. Yeah. I think you should teach Shakespeare. Even if what Shakespeare says is uncomfortable for us, there was another example actually about a year ago. There were who was it? It was Melville or something like that. They were going to change Melville's text.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Do you remember?
Yeah, I remember some
for school kids or something, you know, to make it more.
No, it was. Huckleberry Finn.
Huckleberry Finn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mark Twain. Yeah. Huckleberry Finn.
Yeah, because there was some... I think it was the word nigger.
Nigger was in it. That was it, yeah. So they're going to change it.
A few of these kind of terms in the book that they wanted to change. Because they're inappropriate.
Inappropriate in the modern
political context. Correctness.
That's right. And there were two schools of thought on this. It was an interesting debate. I mean... It's difficult when you start messing around with text, isn't it? Changing text because it doesn't fit your community of reception. So, go on. What were you going to say?
I was going to go back to the other point. Here in the very beginning of his essay, page 3-5, at the bottom there, he says that there's sort of these two opposite views that are always presented, that either there is a literal meaning of the utterance, and we should be able to say what it is, or there are as many meanings as there are readers, and no one of them is literal.
Yeah.
But he doesn't like that opposition, so he says, the answer suggested by my little story is that the utterance has two literal meanings.
Yeah.
Within the circumstances assumed by my colleague, the utterance is obviously a question about whether or not there is a required textbook in this particular course.
Yes.
But within the circumstances to which he was alerted by his student's corrective response, the utterance is just as obviously a question about the instructor's position.
Yes.
And so he
on the state of the text, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and so it says, notice that we do not have here a case of indeterminacy or undecidability, but of determinacy and decidability that do not always have the same shape and that can, and in this instance, in this instance do change.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. So it's not a matter of interpretation, it's a matter of you've got two literal meanings.
Yeah.
Yeah. Two legitimate readings.
Is that possible, or is that?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, well, he's argued that it is, isn't it? I guess you've got two literal meanings of it. Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, that's right. Why do we always think of a literal meaning as only being one?
Yes.
Why can't you have several literal meanings of a text?
He's always jumped to like, it's the objective position, like the one truth, isn't it?
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily mean that, does it?
As I was reading this, I was thinking of Madhva, who reads the Vedas, and he argues that the Veda, which is generally taken to be sort of a polytheistic text, he argues it's a monotheistic text, and he says the literal meaning of all the names of the various gods are names of the one god.
Oh, okay.
But at the same time, he says the other reading where the references to the many gods, he says that's also a literal meaning.
Oh.
So you have two literal meanings of the text.
Oh.
And he says, well, one is the primary literal meaning, the other one is the secondary literal meaning.
Uh-huh.
So somewhat perhaps similar to here, the student is,
yes,
is perhaps the primary literal meaning is there a text, is there
textbook?
Well, you know, the other one.
Oh, the other one, yeah.
She means.
Yeah. The primary literal meaning is what her intended meaning is.
He doesn't say that, but.
Yeah,
that's sort of how I took it.
And the secondary literal meaning is the way it could be taken, as is there a textbook in this class.
Yes, the context where the other interpretation was perfect. It's the first day of the course.
Yeah,
that's what students ask normally.
Yes,
you have to read something for the
yes,
class.
Yes, Yes. And in a different class, that would have been the primary meaning, in a sense. But in Fish's class, because she's one of Fish's victims or whatever, it's it means that, yeah. Yeah. That's right, yeah.
Sorry, this is very basic, but when you talk about the semiotic triangle, is that text, reader, and community?
Yeah, it's text...
reader and community?
No, text, what it refers to, the meaning of the text.
Oh, text meaning.
And community of reception.
Ah.
Or syme, what it signifies, and the interpretant, community of interpretation. Semiotic triangle, the thirdness that Peirce goes on about.
Okay.
I'm not sure whether this example fit with Fish's theory, but when Oxford movement took place and Cardinal John Henry Newman suggests that the community of reading the scripture is not the university but in the church, especially through the church fathers. I think it's a reorganization of the context and try to offer an authoritative context of interpretation. I'm not sure whether it is a good example of Fish's.
I think it's totally parallel. So Newman's the Oxford movement and Newman, they moved away from a kind of Protestant sola scriptura position, then that the text isn't self-interpreting, but is mediated through the fathers and so on. Is that right? Yeah. So the text, would their position be with regard to, would they say that the text has objective meaning outside of the community of reception? It's not the language they would use, but...
So what he further suggested was the language of interpretation should be drawn from the rituals?
Should be.
Yes, so like a scientific language cannot point to the subject of the theology. So ritualistic language can describe the subject better than scientific language.
Better than which language?
Scientific, like yes. Historical criticism.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. I think that's right. So the true meaning of the text, if Newman, is understood through the liturgical lens, looking at it through liturgy. Yeah. Well, that's true of the Vedas too, isn't it? I mean, the Vedas is liturgical text.
Of course, Fritz Tom will argue that it doesn't have a meaning.
Yeah, he argues there's no meaning.
But I think it's in a Hindu context, this is very true, where you have the sacred texts that are read and interpreted. But then they're always sort of understood within a tradition, within a community of people that sort of have, that live in a context that is provided by previous people in that tradition. And so they always look at the text in that light. And so when the text says something, they automatically take it to be that. And you go to a different tradition, they're reading the same text and the same passage. But for them, that passage means something very different because they have a different community or a different sort of set of assumptions that they pre-read the text already very differently. Because you don't really, in a Hindu context, you don't really have this this notion of sola scriptura. It's always within a context of a lineage or a tradition or a school, and you understand the text.
Mm. But you understand it objectively within that tradition. The claim is that it's there. That's the true meaning, isn't it? So there's no scientific meaning in that that sense. But the philologist comes along and says, "Ah, yes, we've got a scientific meaning of this text. Objective scientific meaning, established through a scientific method."
But even then, there's a divide, isn't there? Because it's almost like even when you're talking about these traditions, interpreting texts differently, religious, philosophical traditions interpreting a text, that can then be separate, that can be seen as even one attitude towards a text, in that it's approaching it with the idea that something could be perhaps multivocal and kind of transcend the sort of scientific parameters of the kind of other truth, which is within the communities of the technical subjects or something like this. And they seem to hold up a truth which is different from the kind of artistic communities, who are talking about another truth, but both would say they were a truth.
Mm.
So you have people who argue that there's like mythos on the one hand and logos on the other.
Yep.
And they're both truths, but they're so different. If you were to take one idea which was true within this community and place it within the other, it would have no import whatsoever, because it just doesn't fit within their framework whatsoever. So even with all these different interpretations of a religious text, they can still be brought within a kind of umbrella community of a kind of mythic reading against a logic or
logostic
meaning.
Yeah, logostic.
Which perhaps wouldn't understand the import.
Yeah.
I think the I mean it's a, I'm thinking of the Sanskrit reading class on teaching literature today. You know, where we read one text and we read two commentaries on that text, and it's two commentaries from a very different religious tradition, and it's sort of you kind of you know, we always read one commentator and then we read the other one, and you sort of read the first one and you kind of go like, well, that's a really nice interpretation, and you sort of, this makes sense, and this is sort of a literal reading of the text. Then you go to the other one and you get, you know, it's often equally convincing, the reading, and it's sort of, I think we particularly in philology, that there's a tendency of to sort of say, well, this is a wrong reading, this is a right reading, and so on. But I think what his idea is useful for is to say, well, the question of whether this is a right or a wrong reading is sort of irrelevant. It's just a question of how can these two readings exist alongside each other? How can two people interpret this text in very different ways and make, you know, a sense of the text in such different ways and still offer a literal reading without having to say, well, this is symbolical or this is metaphorical or something like that, but actually just come up with two different readings, because they have two different contexts.
So in a sense, both of those would have to agree on, In Judaism, there's this distinction between the plain sense of the text and the interpreted sense. So the plain sense, they would have to agree on it. They have to be established. So you could say that philology is about the plain sense of the text, whereas interpreted readings are...
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, for those two commentators who are reading, you know, they'll argue that the other person is wrong, because they're sort of embedded within that tradition,
of course,
context. But for somebody who's sort of standing outside of that, you know, it's like the girl says, you know, no, you've misunderstood my question.
Yeah.
I'm not asking about that, but I'm asking, you know, this, about this other thing. And so she says, well, you've misinterpreted my comment. But Fish seems to be arguing that the other interpretation was not a wrong interpretation, maybe it must be an appropriate interpretation, but it was a correct interpretation.
Yeah.
And I think as sort of if you belong to one of those traditions, you sort of see, okay, the other interpretation is wrong, is inappropriate or whatever. But if you sort of stand outside of it and engage in sort of the study of these ideas and the way these texts are interpreted, then he seems to allow a sort of have a model where you can make room for that.
Indeed, yeah, he does. Yeah. So it's a kind of generous reading in a way, isn't it? Generous position. because you allow for variation and you're not monological. It's you allow for other voices. Yeah, yeah.
Because a philologist might say, well, this person, you know, Shankara is obviously misreading this text because this text, you know, comes from the 6th century BC and never have said anything like that.
Yeah.
And he's reading, you know, sort of something into it that's obviously from the 8th century or whatever.
Yes, yes, yes.
But he sort of sidesteps that, I think, very well. At least that's how I applied his idea. So if you sidestep that issue and say, well, you know, that, let's just ignore that and just assume you have this utterance there and how can it be read? And, and, you know, sort of depending on the context.
That's true, isn't it? I mean, all texts, in a sense, are equal to us regardless of their historical depth for us as readers. Kerr makes that point too. Well, I can see both. I'm kind of torn between the notion of objectivity of the text established through philology and the text purely exists within the community of reception. So that's why I find that Jewish distinction quite useful in a plain sense and interpreted sense. So Fish isn't interested particularly in the plain... Well, he is interested in the plain sense, isn't he? But he complexifies it. Is there more than one plain sense?
I think the difficulty with the objective notion of the text in philology is that you often dismiss centuries of engagement with the text as sort of irrelevant or wrong or...
That's a problem.
Which, I mean, that's perhaps not a problem, but I would say it's unfortunate. It's sort of. I find that just to be more interesting.
yes, it's the textual reception, which is what's interesting.
But the fact that he almost told that story, it was almost like a joke, almost like a trick. And he knew that it would sound, it would be, I'm sure the girl knew that it was a trick when she asked.
Oh.
I don't think she did, actually. I think it was a genuine question.
Do you?
Yeah, and that she just, you know, after she said it, that she realised, oh, this could have been interpreted very differently as he did.
Yeah.
That's the impression.
So knowing that Fish's class was knowing Fish and knowing what the class was like, asked naively, isn't it always a naive question?
But she wasn't asking Fish; she was asking another.
Oh yeah, sorry,
another teacher.
Asking the other teacher.
She will have probably anticipated that his response would be, "Oh, it's Horton's Anthology or whatever."
Yeah.
And so, to me, it sounded like it was a trick.
Yeah.
And like so many jokes and tricks work on the fact that there is always the meaning which is the most likely, the most presumed, and then there's another meaning which is very unlikely, and that's why it's funny, because it tricks you into going one path when actually we're talking about something different. And so it did, to me, it does argue, well, of course, there, you know, the meaning is context dependent, but there is still this kind of overriding meaning which most people will, the one main path that most people will go down.
Yeah.
And of course there's this other little path, but it's less likely that you're going to choose that, and that's precisely why tricks and jokes and things work, because
that's right.
They kid you into thinking that the main path
is
the way.
That's right.
It wasn't.
That's right.
So, but it still says that the literal path is the main road, even if the slight kind of subcultural context is
also legitimate. There could also be a legitimate understanding, but that's where you get puns and all that kind of thing, ambiguity of puns. Just a minute's good on that. We've got to stop now, so well, thanks for coming to these 5 seminars. Next week I'm not here, but if you want to carry on, we could look at Heteroglossia, we could look at Bakhtin if you want, for 2 weeks. Anyone interested in that?
Okay.
Okay. So look at.
Is it on the list?
No, it's not on there. Because this was the last one, technically. But we can do two more sessions if you like on. It's either Bakhtin or Voloshinov. It's called Marxism and the Philosophy of Language.
Yeah,
Voloshinov. Oh, it is on the list.
Yeah.
When were we going to do that?
Sorry?
When were we supposed to do that?
It's just in the sort of general bibliography.
Oh, okay,
at
then.
The end of the
yeah.
thing you gave
in
the first
week. Yeah. We'll look at chapter one of Marxism and the Philosophy of Language. It talks about the dominant, the philosophy of the sign.
Who's that by again, sorry?
That's Voloshinov. Voloshinov.
Voloshinov.
From the Bakhtin school. An English translation. Does anyone read Russian? Do you read Russian?
I know, but...
Do you? Yeah. It's very difficult, I think.
Maybe not as difficult as Sanskrit.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's probably just as difficult as Sanskrit.
They have discrete words. We don't
want to get. So we got. I've got a meeting at 11:30, but we've got readings in the Sanskrit readings, haven't we? No. For half an hour. Or did I cancel it last week? No, I can't remember either.
Hey.
So if anyone turns up, we'll carry on.
Yeah.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for coming to these seminars.
Well, thank you very much.